Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Mrs. Future and I have the distinct pleasure of bringing in live from Peru, Dr. Bruce Damer, one of our favorite indie Renaissance scientists at large.
Yes, our modern age, Newton meets Haley meets, I don't know, so you tell us, Bruce.
Yeah, we're catching up with Bruce and, you know, what's going on in his world. You know, Bruce is known for everything from studying outer space and working with asteroid capture processes to the origin of life research.
Yeah, we love to have Bruce on a few times a year just to catch up with what happened a million years ago.
And, you know, you've been down in Peru in the jungle. I mean, that's where life oozes out of every crevice. Does that have anything to do with the origin of life, Bruce?
Yeah, it's extremely inspiring. You know, we went way upriver from Pucallpa, which is this incredible lumber, illegal gold mining, an agricultural boom town on the banks of the Ucayali River, and saw all kinds of things from jaguars to toucans. You know, right where I was sleeping, the toucan flew and stood right and looked at me, and it was an enormous beak, and minor birds and monkeys and spiders the size of your hand, fuzzy black spiders that dig holes, and they live in, you know, like the spider in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just like that. I mean,
wow. Now, was this scary? I mean, how did you deal with all these creatures around you? Was it comfortable?
It was okay. You know, we had a guide, and we were trekking and hiking and eating fish from the river, and so there was no worries about that. Hmm. It's just a visionary, inspiring environment that I go to when I can. Last year, I went to Machu Picchu in the Sacred Valley in Peru. It's my break from myself.
Mm-hmm. No. Lose yourself in the jungle, huh?
I do, and it's been so intense this year with all the publications and the TEDx talks and the expedition to Mount Lassen Volcanic Park 3 weeks ago.
Right, ago. I remember that. And it is interesting because I wonder whether or not you've had any new thoughts on origin of life here. I mean, I believe you were starting to think that possibly life may have evolved from land rather than from the sea. Is that right?
Yeah, and I've actually just completed an essay for a fairly major journal in the field called Astrobiology Journal, and the essay was submitted 2 weeks ago, and it argues the case from all the research of the last 10 years that I've been doing with my colleague Dave Deemer.
Here at UC Santa Cruz,
and I came up with this flash of insight while in Australia in July. Mm-hmm. We were on the trail of what's called a stromatolite, which are the oldest fossils in the fossil record.
What, they were some of the earliest life forms on this planet?
They were, and like they're microbial net communities, and they're just kind of...
Okay, well, you're cutting in and out a little bit. Microbial net communities, I think.
Microbial life, and did you say 4 million years ago?
3.5 million, 4 million?
3.5 billion years
billion,
old.
Billion, right.
Yeah, and they are the oldest fossils that you can find, and they're rare. We went to a colony of stromatolites in the Western Australia, and then we snorkeled among them, and they look kind of like rock towers pointing out of the water. And they were the great smokestack polluters of their day. They produced the oxygen I breathe.
Oh, so they basically destroyed their atmosphere, huh, at the time?
Yeah, they turned an Earth. This is why, say, the panspermia theory doesn't really hold much water, that life could have come sort of raining down from elsewhere, because the early Earth, when a planet like the Earth forms, it's really dirty. It's rock that's...
You know, Bruce, for whatever reason, you're kind of clicking in and out. So stay real close to the mic, okay?
Yep. When planets form and they cool, their atmospheres are real messy. And so life actually has to take hold of that and clean it up, clean up the planet. And in our case, the origin of life happened, and then it took 2.5 billion years for life forms to vacuum out the atmosphere and clean the oceans, and then give us oxygen so that we can have complex multicellular life. So
does this suggest that the stromatolites are in Australia? Does that mean life on this planet began in Australia, or that's just where they are still surviving?
There's a chunk of Australia. So Australia used to be connected to Antarctica. And before that, they were all one supercontinent.
Pangaea, right?
even earlier than Pangaea, there was sort of a supercontinent. And there's a hunk of Australia that is the oldest chunk of the planet of continental crust. And it's like a ship. And it's been floating around. It's never sort of gotten sunk like most of the other early continental pieces.
Yeah.
And on it have been preserved these fossils from way back.
Hmm. Fascinating.
So we literally drove 3,000 kilometers into this area and hiked with expert geologists up to these rock outcroppings so you could literally touch the remnants of the oldest life on Earth.
Did you have a Shazam experience? Did they talk to you?
Well, they kind of did, because as we went from the ocean shore back and we went to all these different environments back up to the 3.5 billion year old fossil deposit, I kind of worked out how it may have evolved, how this whole thing may have started.
Really?
Yeah, it came as a flash one day, standing on this hilltop, realizing, wait a minute, the origin of life is the origin of these stromatolites, these microbial mats. In order to explain how life started, you have to explain how these mats came about. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to do that is to think of, if you're taking a bath, say if you're taking a bubble bath, you know, everyone's taken bubble baths at least sometime in their lives. Have you guys taken a bubble bath?
Absolutely.
shout out from Galen. She says she's listening on her car radio now.
And I'm sure I totally relate with being evolved from a life form that liked to take bubble baths.
Yes. Life may have been a bubble bath.
You mean a bubble bath at the base of some volcano on the land somewhere?
Yeah.
In a pool of water?
Maybe? Yeah, good insight. Bases of volcanoes, you get these wonderful hot spring systems that pump. There's geysers that go off all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes mud pots. And they're really rich environments, and they concentrate goodies. So think of a warm bathtub being filled and refilled and then dried out and filled again and dried out. That creates kind of like an engine. Every time you dry that bathtub out with the soap in it, these films of soap form a bathtub ring.
I see. So the bathtub rings reveal much about what happened there then.
Yeah. And we can do this in the lab. We have a machine that does this, makes sort of little simulated bathtubs in the lab at UCSC.
Really? Analyzes and volcanic pool bathtub rings?
What we did, we sort of simulated it with simple chemistry, simple compounds. Hmm. And in last month, Dave and I went up to what's called Bumpus Hell, which is this incredible hot spring thermal field up in Northern California, and looked at those pools and put our samples in these hot vents to see if we could get pretty cool compounds form, like things that are like RNA form.
Let's see if those are the right environment to begin to generate life in some way, you know?
Yeah. So the whole story is, the way the insight came in Australia was I realized when the bathtub fills, you get lots of bubbles floating in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But if bathtubs drain, say if you're drying out your bathtub, that takes a lot longer. And if you dry it out, these bubbles will form this foam as you dry it down. And they eventually form what's called a gel or a hydrogel.
Mm-hmm.
And in that hydrogel phase, it's kind of like sludge.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the phase in which everything is jostled together. You have all the concentrated amino acids and nucleotides that came in from space or in your kind of hot spring bathtub. And the bubbles get crowded together. And the ones that don't pop, the ones that stay around, have something working in their favor. It may have been that they accidentally contain a little bit of protein that made them stable and others popped. And it's that environment, that gel, where the action is, and that's a really, I feel it's a viable place where life started as a community.
The popped bubble ecosystem of the primordial muck.
All right, let's take a little break here on that wonderful concept, and we're going to come back with more of the Dr. Future Show and go a little deeper into the primordial muck. Stay tuned with our guest, Bruce Damer. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer. about origin of life, about the, I believe, the ecosystem that would exist if bubbles popped in the primordial muck that created life for the first time.
Yeah, you know, Bruce,
near a volcano, right?
I've been a big fan of the idea that we are bags of water, you know, walking bags of water that came out of the ocean. But it sounds like what you're saying is that we're walking bags of lava that came out of the earth.
Yeah, and in fact, Mrs. Future, here's why we don't believe life came from the ocean. If you eat a big bag of salty chips, what do you feel like usually? Like you got too
much
salt?
I love to do that.
You want to eat more?
Yeah, actually, I'm sort of salt deficient. Eating a big bag of salty chips puts me in the balance.
Me too, but you know, for a lot of us, you start feeling like bloated.
Oh, right. It sucks all your water up, right?
Yeah.
That's right. And what's going on is the salt is going into your cells and they're furiously trying to get rid of it because eventually it will just pop them. And if you use seawater in any of these experiments on origin of life, and even the teams that are doing this at NASA, they would never use seawater because it would gum up all their reactions. And it turns out that cells today, they're a much lower salt content than the sea is, and that the sea was billions of years ago. So it's just inconceivable that cells could have evolved where there was lots of water present all the time, like seawater.
Okay, so the ancient ocean was less salty than it is today?
It was about as salty, but it also contained kind of a whole lot of nasty, what are called divalent cations, which would block reactions that would, say, form your DNA or your RNA.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you have a chemical reaction that goes on in the ocean, say at one of those hot vents, it might form some cool molecules, but every chemical reaction has a back reaction if there's water around. So the water forces the molecule to come apart. You can never save any of the results of what you've done. Whereas in the bathtub, you rely on the bathtub drying down and the water leaving through dehydration, giving you energy to make all these goodies, make your sludge. Because water's not around, the sludge stays around. And then when water comes back, the sludge gets another shot at evolution. It gets another shot to see whether bubbles pop or don't pop.
Interesting. And so if water wasn't the source of life, you're saying it was the dehydration process, like going back and forth from being hydrated to being dried out?
Yeah, that's the pump. And in fact, the reason I got this insight in Australia is we were driving through the outback and it had just rained and there were all these plants coming up from the soil. And I realized, wait a minute, that's hydration. The plants go from a dehydrated state where they're super, super low metabolism or they're just seeds with nothing going on, and then they suddenly bloom out into the outback. And this is still going on today. And they're coming from something called soil, but soil is full of little microbes. Soil is mostly microbes. It's mostly single-celled things.
Doing stuff.
Doing stuff. And we are just parasites that live off microbial mat communities that still dominate the planet.
Really?
Yeah, and
I thought we were the crown of creation, Bruce. What are you talking about?
Are you saying that the microbes have mined? I mean, the microbes are doing all the work, and we're just taking a free ride on the microbes?
Yep, you, me, and the redwood tree.
Well, but the microbes started first, right? They would be the primordial mat made from the primordial muck that would lead to higher life forms. Right, but it all come from the mat.
The mat is where it's at.
So are you rewriting the tree of life here? Like there's a whole new layer of the tree of life that's like the biggest layer and it was invisible before and it's called the microbes?
Yeah. In fact, in the essay that's now in peer review, I actually suggested that this essay is actually the roots of the tree of life. It explains the roots underground that no one's been able to see all this time. Because you know, the trunk is where you clearly see some kind of a cell doing a neat thing. And it's the cell can divide on its own and do all that stuff. But in order to divide on its own, it needs all this machinery. And the roots are all, or you would say roots here in America, the roots are all the pathways to make that first cell a big enough machine to do its own tricks. And that is the gel. That's this idea of the gel that was before the microbial mat. And it's crowding together of bubbles, gradually getting more function, till one day you could call it alive.
Huh. Now, what do you think the very first microbe would do?
Well, you know, in this model, there wasn't a first microbe.
It just happened. It is a mat. The mat happened first?
The mat was the unit.
You're saying the colony came before the cell?
The colony came before individual independent cells, yeah.
Wow.
Because in this model, you can imagine you have foam. Say when you're down at Santa Cruz, you're down on the beach and you see sea foam flowing in.
The froth, and yeah.
Froth. Most of it doesn't make it. You know, after a while, it's full of all kinds of goodies, but it's not alive.
Mm-hmm.
And what this model proposes is that foam, in the right conditions where it's being dried, as you say, sun dehydrated and rehydrated, with goodies added into the soup mix, that foam, I call it a gel or a hydrogel, gradually acquires new properties that make it more stable. So the foam just stays along. It becomes like a meringue.
So the foam becomes alive.
It's froth.
The foam, yeah, the froth, the foam, or the gel gradually get the tools to be more stable. Mm. And that means there's some kind of little metabolic digestive process going on here, and then there's another process that pulls new material in there, and it can be distributed across the foam. So the entire foam and all the individual, what are called protocells, can benefit from anything that works.
Boy, talk about a new myth here. I mean, Aphrodite is going to have to move over. Right?
So it was a foam before a mat, or was it both at the same time?
Well, it was. So when you look at these microbial mat communities, if you go out to the desert, if you go to Arizona or Nevada or whatnot, you see these things everywhere on the ground. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of crusts. They're kind of like tan-colored crusts, or they can be black. And they can live where nothing else can. And if you pour water on them, try this sometime.
Bruce, can we continue us after the news? We got a hard break.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Got it.
Can you hold on? Okay, thanks.
All right, folks. Dr. Future Show with Bruce Damer. And we'll be back after CBS News. Thanks for listening.
We've got a transmitter, and we're not afraid to use it.
Okay. Can you recap a little bit, Bruce?
You can find these things, these microbial mats, if you go out to the desert, the high desert.
Hmm.
And they're like crusts on the ground, and they can be like black things on rocks too, called desert varnishes. And if you take out a water bottle and you pour water on them, they start to bulk up and come alive. If you took a piece of that and stuck it under a microscope, you could see millions and billions of individual cells, some of which capture sunlight, other which do chemical stuff underneath them, and they're a cooperative community, and those are our ancestors. They are our oldest ancestors.
Are there modern versions of these same life forms in existence today?
They're everywhere. They're all over the deserts. They're at really salty pools. They're anywhere where animals don't come and eat them.
Hmm. And it sounds like they're doing some eating at their own little microbial
now,
level.
How vast is their communication network? I mean, are they in touch with each other, or are they isolated communities?
They can be pretty vast. And in fact, they evolved into what we call soils now.
Okay. So soils are part of the microbial mats.
That's so interesting. Kind of so like
derivative.
The biologists, like organic farmers, have been discovering that microbes are really good for their crops. And it turns out that it's the other way around. It's like microbes made crops.
Yep. In fact, when I was in the rainforest here, I had a thought that I said, you know, all this came from those simple films of microbes. Plants came at around 500-700 million years ago, or actually maybe 300-400 million, in little ponds. Plants emerged on the land.
Recent? I mean, less than a billion years ago?
Yeah. Land plants are new creations. So the microbial communities cranked away for 3 billion years to prepare the ground, literally like gardeners, to give us the ability to have fungus and then plants.
So does this have implications for, say, our space program, in that we're looking for water planets And I guess that's good for us if we were going to find life like ourselves at the kind of evolution that we have now, but it's almost like a little irrelevant. You must be in some kind of cafe there in Peru, huh? You got a little kid in the background.
Yeah, what's the scene there, Bruce?
Yeah, there's a little absolutely freaked out.
There's a little kid, I think I caught.
Costo Hotel in Lima, Peru.
Oh.
Right.
And mother is trying to calm down for little kids. I'm going to walk over here.
Brilliant.
Okay, well, we do have a question from the audience on this, too. What do you think of the brackish salt that was discovered on Mars recently? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, Bruce? I think in terms of life, because you were saying that it would be a lot less, at least for life on this planet, it would appear to be much less salty than this brackish material found on Mars. So does this suggest life to you, or do you need more evidence?
Mars certainly had water. It certainly had oceans.
So Mars had water, Mars and water and oceans, fresh water?
It could have had somewhat salty water, but it could have had rainfall. And rainfall creates distilled fresh water. When you have rain, you have fresh water. So that's how you make water fresh. And so Mars probably had that early on, and they know that they had oceans. But was it enough for life to start?
Well, are there any bathtub rings there?
Well, one of the, you know, well, the Curiosity Mars rover found a rock outcropping that is basically at the base of the volcano that they're climbing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So they found evidence of hot water surface springs on Mars.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's good news. Yeah. So looking at that more closely seems like a good thing to do.
Yeah, it's all incredibly exciting. You know, we live in the best, I find myself just thrilled that I'm able to do this work now with all of this planetary exploration going on and new chemistry going on and working with Dave Deamer. And by the way, the listeners, if they Google Bruce Deamer TEDx or TEDx Santa Cruz Bruce Deamer, you can watch two TED Talks, one of them being about this very origin of life model.
Mm-hmm. And the other being about your space work.
About the space work. And they link together. You'll see in the TEDx Talks in a cool way how they link together.
Before I met you even, Bruce, I believe, or maybe it was after I met you, but the first time that I encountered David Deamer was in his talk at NASA as an astrobiologist. And that's when I learned that NASA actually is consulting those historians of the origin of life, such as David Deamer, such as yourself, to know what to look for on the far planets, to know which ones we should aim for in terms of doing our research, right? Because there's a relationship between how life evolved on Earth and what we want to find as we're looking at the billions of stars out there, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and Dave has been on advisory committees for spacecraft destinations.
Right.
Now, since you've been away, there's been a big hit movie in the theaters here called The Martian.
Bruce. Yes.
Yeah, you haven't seen that yet, I guess, but I guess you will when you get back.
But very excited about it, yeah.
It's bringing the space back into mainstream thinking again a little bit. And one of the things that we're looking at is that this old argument of manned spacecraft versus robots going to the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you think of the viability of robotic ships that could go to all the planets and give us more direct experiences of those planets that way and without having to leave the planet? Doesn't that seem like a higher option to you than trying to move these bodies which are designed for this planet?
Yeah, see, Dr. Future wants to populate the planets of our solar system with Curiosity-type robots.
Well, they're extensions of our consciousness.
That are giving
as
us
McLuhan would say,
shows that we can tune into through our virtual reality.
Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I think practically we're not going to be going to send people to Mars for a long time, 40, 50 years.
They're saying 2030s in the NASA's new program today. But that's optimistic in your estimation, right?
Yeah, nobody's making a serious investment yet. So we haven't really even started. It may be that Elon Musk and SpaceX build enough of a framework. They don't have a gas station in Mars orbit yet.
Right, that was part of your work, right, is to build the gas station network to get to the other planets.
Exactly. And you have to build infrastructure. I'm sure that in the movie Martian, it took them 2 years to turn around and go and get that fellow.
Yeah.
One of the things that's not very realistic about the movie, from what I've read, is it's likely that human crews will likely stay mostly in orbit and make short visits to the surface. They won't try to build a greenhouse and build a base because the surface is a harsh environment. Mm-hmm. If you have a large enough spacecraft, you have a clean environment, access to resources when you're in orbit, especially if you've captured an asteroid and you've taken the volatiles off with a Shepard spacecraft, which is our other work. But you want to make what are called sortie missions. And this is very much like how they did the Apollo landings. Hmm. One guy stayed in orbit and they went down and made a short visit and then came back. And actually, by the time the Apollo crews came back, equipment was somewhat trashed. I mean, they had dust everything. The stuff was failing after 2 or 3 days. They would come back to a relatively clean environment and go back to the Earth. And that's going to be the model, I believe, for Mars as well. To set up facilities on the surface, at least in the first go-round, is just going to be really tough.
Mm. Well, in the story here, they had a series of expeditions, and while one was underway, they were prepping the setting for the next one, where they have some of the materials already sent in advance before the humans arrived. That sort of thinking, you know, which kind of made sense.
That makes sense. Yeah. I understand it was written by a serious engineer from JPL, so
it's actually
got some good engineering in it.
Oh, it did. It had a lot of feedback. There's one of the interesting things about the net is that it allowed him to get a lot of feedback from other scientists to get the facts straight. And I think that helped. It made the film good. Can we do a little thought exercise here for a moment? If you wanted to spread biological life through our solar system, and if you weren't, say, just focused on necessarily getting humans there, but it could be microbes, okay? What areas in the solar system should we check out the most, do you think? Where would life most likely be able to exist? The extremophiles exist on other planets.
Well, certain polar ice caps, say at the margins where you get some melting.
On Mars?
Yep, yeah, you're lost getting you out a little sketchy there, Bruce.
Wait, Bruce, which planet? Was it Mars? Is that what you're talking about? I just go back. You're saying the polar ice caps melting, and I assume you're speaking of Mars.
Yes, yeah, that's a pretty good candidate, but just for microbes, not for plants.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I guess microbes would be the easiest to place in the solar system if we had to seed life through our particular solar system, right?
And there's another way to do it, which may be more practical, just to capture a large icy asteroid and melt it inside a container and then create a biosphere, just like those glass globe of biospheres.
Hmm. And that would live in space?
In space, yeah, a floating globule that's lit by lighting that's from solar panels on the outside of your balloon that actually your fabric structure.
Oh.
And on the inside, you have this melted globule with an Earth-like atmosphere. And that's probably the more practical way of bringing an entire ecosystem intact and inoculating that globule. And then you would harvest that for crews in space.
Hmm.
That's the biosphere version of the Shepard design.
Okay. Cool, great. We got to go for a break. Could you hold on for the last 10 minutes, Bruce?
Yeah, hopefully we'll keep our bandwidth stable.
Yeah, okay,
thank
good.
Thank you. Okay, we'll be right back, folks, to the Dr. Future Show.
Okay, we're back on the Dr. Future Show. We have Dr. Bruce Damer talking about origin of life on the line. And we have Billy Sunshine just walked into the studio here. He's going to be listening and maybe asking a question or two in the process. And Bruce, just for the general audience, the non-scientist in you, why is the origin of life important?
We can figure out and maybe even replicate not all the steps to life, but life in the lab, see how we may have begun. It's going to open our eyes to maybe see how ourselves and our world in a new way.
Hmm.
So Sun was getting at this earlier when she was saying, I always thought we came from something that was sort of cooperative, you know, and we can say execute this model in the lab and see our little foam, our little gel start to grow and little processes that look life-like start to happen in them. We realize that maybe life started as a community, kind of communal unit, and that, in fact, all of life is a cooperative communal unit. It's rather than sort of survival of the fittest, everyone out for their own. which is a philosophy that isn't serving the human world very well at the moment.
We could give up the idea of Adam and Steve or Adam and Eve. Or
that's Billy,
that was
by the way.
To be.
Yeah. So, Billy, you're suggesting that forget the Bible stories about Adam and Eve?
Wouldn't
and,
that be interesting?
And get into the microbial mats?
Oh, we're going back even before that. We're going back to, like, the myth of Western civilizations.
Yes.
And the ideas of the Titans and life forming in the sea. And we're actually saying we need a new deity, maybe like a Hawaiian lava god as the source of life, right?
Yeah, the new myth would be we're all just one big smushy kind of interacting thing that needs all the parts. So, and in fact, that's if you're flying over cities and you look at cars moving and grocery stores being supplied by trucks and food and water flowing, and if you actually visualize human civilization, it's like a microbial community. It's just exactly like it.
You're just another level of complexity, I guess.
Yeah, but individual humans are like microbes.
Inside and our bodies, yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, inside this. So we're a giant gel foam, and the health of the whole planet is because we're now spreading like a foam across the Earth, and we're replacing the previous system with our system, and along with a lot of other biology, but we're just the same process.
So we should trust in this process that we're on course, that the microbes know what they're doing, and we should just relax and enjoy the ride, or what?
I like that.
Yeah?
Well, I think there's something. This idea is so new that I really don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, okay.
It's so new. But it will change our philosophy, I believe. Hmm. You know, it may even change eventually our economics and our politics.
Yeah, well, it does kind of fit in with the Joseph Campbellian idea that the next great myth involves our species, you know, and thinking of ourselves as a whole rather than as Americans or Canadians or Europeans or whatever.
Very good point, Dr. Future. Very good point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering if you had any new insights on your trip to Peru. You know, like, what is oozing out of your brain?
The big insight, actually, I had sitting one night on the river was that a single type of molecule could have kickstarted life in our model, in our cyclical model, a single molecule, and that's called a ribozyme. It's something Dave and I study and many of our colleagues study.
Mm,
and so I saw a ribozyme appear in the model when I was doing a thought experiment and realized, oh my goodness, the ribozyme making a pore to allow things in and out of the bubbles also could make copies of the ribozyme, and you have the kickstarting of the genetic code.
Mm. All right, so the first copies were made by is a ribozyme a type of protein? What kind of structure is that?
It's sort of a type of nucleic acid that folds and twists and whatnot, but it has this weird property of being able to make a copy of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if it sticks itself in the cell membrane and forms a opening, stuff that's coming in will be in and out of the cell, will give it building blocks, but it will come in right where the ribozyme is.
So it's the first mouth.
Very well said. And it's making copies of itself, which make more pores, which make pulse more stuff into the cell. And it starts that whole cycle.
Mm-hmm. Right. So at the tiniest level, we're dealing with a little cell, a little ball of fluid that has a cell membrane that's holding it all together and keeping the inside in and the outside out. And this little ribosome is the first thing that's actually alive that has self-awareness and wants to create more of itself.
Well, you know, nothing would be self-aware, but what would happen is you would see growth.
It would be a machine. So, it would be a machine, right? A molecular machine.
Yeah, and here's the funny thing. As I pose this, as I present this at conferences and in my essay, which I can send anyone out there who's a listener who really wants to dig deeper, if a biologist was walking on the ancient Earth 4 billion years ago and came across the bubbling hot spring and saw this gel at the bottom of a drying out hot spring and took a piece of it and stuck it into another hot spring, they might see it start growing, like it's getting bigger. But if they looked at it under the microscope, they wouldn't see any individual cells, but they would see all this other stuff chemically.
Hmm.
So it's something that does a thing life does, which is grow in size and adapt, but it's not really life yet. And so I put that in the essay saying a biologist wouldn't call this alive, yet, but it's a continuum. You know, it will gradually become more alive.
The Wikipedia definition says a ribosome is a large and complex molecular machine found within all living cells that serves as the site of biological protein synthesis.
That's a ribosome, which is a really high-tech thing. A ribozyme.
Zyme, I'm sorry.
Is a simpler thing, but the ribosome is the thing that makes everything, and it's a massive machine that came later in evolution.
Hmm. So, Bruce, how do all of these thought experiments and machinations of your mind give you a perspective on the future? Like, what do we do with this in terms of creating a better world and having more fun living on the planet?
Yeah, it sounds like we're not really in charge. Our species is part of a much bigger process that...
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And if we don't realize that and we grow too fast and we consume resources too much and change the atmosphere again, we're going to tilt the balance where life loses control of its own climate and things get real nasty. And I don't know how far we are from doing that, but we're putting a ton of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. And it took 3 billion years for microbial communities to put the oxygen in and to take a lot of the nasty stuff like the CO2 out.
But I thought plants love CO2. Like, what is the relationship here between the good that CO2 does for life forms and the fact that putting more of it in there somehow deprives us of oxygen?
Well, it's a delicate balance, because if you have slightly more CO2, you get trapping of sunlight and you get a runaway greenhouse heating effect. Mm-hmm. And so life is constantly pulling CO2 out, recycling it in plant bodies, sticking it in as coal and chalk and whatnot, and sequestering it in the crust and sort of cycling just enough of it through. But if you get too much more, you start getting heating and runaway heating.
So what the atmosphere really wants is just 30% oxygen and no more and no less, something like that.
20%.
Yeah, 20%, and the amount of carbon dioxide is pretty small. And if you look next door at Venus, Venus has a lot of carbon dioxide, and it's got a really dry atmosphere. And Venus could have had oceans, too, in the beginning, but it went into runaway greenhouse, and it's been a hell hole at 900 Fahrenheit at the surface ever since.
I think that's the big fear, that could happen here.
And it could, and James Lovelock, in his new book, and he's 94, and he's one of the great climate scientists of our time. Yeah. And he wrote in his new book that the sun's heat output, watts per square meter, is going to increase in the next just 100 million years. It's going to increase just because the sun's getting hotter. It's like on its lifetime. And it's going to reach a point in 100 million years where we have to have zero CO2 in the atmosphere in order to avoid a runaway greenhouse.
Well, so can we, make a bunch of refrigerators?
Well, life may adapt to this.
That's right. Might not include our species, though, right?
Well, maybe our species will become those refrigerators, Maybe we'll find a way to actually subtract CO2 from the atmosphere as part of our life process.
We do have a story about a test facility in British Columbia that's capturing carbon from the air for an industrial process.
It's probably, in the Amazon rainforest where I was, I went there a few years ago to the same area, and now it's all been slashed and burned.
Really?
Agriculture,
wow.
And there's cows there, yeah. There's a brand new pipeline road with bridges being built, and
yeah,
so the
and
farmers
the whole,
move in.
The
yeah.
Pachamama Foundation, I guess, is really big on teaching that the main reason that we're losing the Amazon is because the search for gold is causing people to land in the middle of the forest and turn it into greenhouse gases. Anyway, Bruce, it's been really great talking to you. It's time for us to go. Thanks for being with us here on the Dr. Future Show.
You want to know
more?
You got to go more? We'll send it www.damer.com, right?
That's it. And my Levity Zone podcast.
Levity Zone. Levity
okay.
Zone.
All right, folks. This is KSEO in Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.